Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Comunidad Autónoma de Canarias. Pruebas de certificación de nivel C1. Inglés. Prueba de comprensión auditiva. Convocatoria ordinaria de 2014.
Task 1. Listen to 5 pieces of radio news and match one of the headings, 1 to 8, to one of the extracts, A to E. There are 3 headings you will not need. Item 0 is given as an example. You will hear the recording twice. Now you have 1 minute to read through the headings. Example.
With thousands of homes damaged throughout the tri-state area by Hurricane Sandy, those families will spend this week focused on rebuilding their lives. But with every storm comes its fair share of scammers. How do you know which contractors to trust? Joining us right now is the famous Angie Hicks. She is the founder of Angie's List that you find on the internet. You can call as well. Angie, good morning to you.
Text A.
From Perth, Courtney Bembridge reports.
Prosecutors have spent the past 3 months attempting to prove Mr. Rainey murdered his wife Corin in August 2007 at the Como home the couple shared with their 2 daughters. Today he was acquitted of both murder and manslaughter. In his reasons, Justice Brian Martin said endeavours by the state to fill critical gaps and explain away improbabilities were no more than speculation without foundation in the evidence. He said the state's case was beset by improbabilities and uncertainties and lacked logic in many ways. He said the evidence.
Text B.
The Deputy Prime Minister has warned Tory rebels that they have absolutely no hope of forcing the European Union to cut its budget. That's after the coalition was defeated in the Commons last night over EU spending.
Ed Balls knows only too well from bitter experience that there is absolutely no prospect of securing a real terms cut to the European Union budget. But at the 11th hour, and having stayed silent on the issue for months, Labour now proclaims that actually this is what they've wanted all along.
Text C.
Well, Colin, the incident happened on the M1 motorway city-bound between the Portadown and Lurgan exits of the motorway. We understand the prison officer was travelling into work at McGabbery Prison when he was ambushed. Now, we are not yet being told whether or not that means gunmen opened fire who'd been lying in wait in the fields alongside the motorway, or if they drew alongside his vehicle in another car and opened fire. But either way, those shots caused his car to leave the road, and he has died as a result of that incident.
Text D.
Syrian state television says an Air Force general, Abdullah Mahmoud al-Khalidi, has been assassinated by rebel forces in the capital, Damascus. The Free Syrian Army said it killed him. Meanwhile, Syrian Air Force jets and helicopter gunships have intensified their attacks on rebel positions.
Text E.
The European Court of Human Rights has ruled that a Polish teenager who was raped and became pregnant should have been given unhindered access to an abortion. Staff at 3 hospitals in Poland denied the 14-year-old girl a termination, even though abortion is legal in cases of rape.
Listen again. Example.
With thousands of homes damaged throughout the tri-state area by Hurricane Sandy, those families will spend this week focused on rebuilding their lives. But with every storm comes its fair share of scammers. How do you know which contractors to trust? Joining us right now is the famous Angie Hicks. She is the founder of Angie's List that you find on the internet. You can call as well. Angie, good morning to you.
Text A.
From Perth, Courtney Bembridge reports.
Prosecutors have spent the past 3 months attempting to prove Mr. Rainey murdered his wife Corin in August 2007 at the Como home the couple shared with their two daughters. Today he was acquitted of both murder and manslaughter. In his reasons, Justice Brian Martin said endeavours by the state to fill critical gaps and explain away improbabilities were no more than speculation without foundation in the evidence. He said the state's case was beset by improbabilities and uncertainties and lacked logic in many ways. He said the evidence.
Text B.
The Deputy Prime Minister has warned Tory rebels that they have absolutely no hope of forcing the European Union to cut its budget. That's after the coalition was defeated in the Commons last night over EU spending.
Ed Balls knows only too well from bitter experience that there is absolutely no prospect of securing a real terms cut to the European Union budget. But at the 11th hour, and having stayed silent on the issue for months, Labour now proclaims that actually this is what they've wanted all along.
Text C.
Well, Colin, the incident happened on the M1 motorway city-bound between the Portadown and Lurgan exits of the motorway. We understand the prison officer was travelling into work at McGabbery Prison when he was ambushed. Now, we are not yet being told whether or not that means gunmen opened fire who'd been lying in wait in the fields alongside the motorway, or if they drew alongside his vehicle in another car and opened fire. But either way, those shots caused his car to leave the road, and he has died as a result of that incident.
Text D.
Syrian state television says an Air Force general, Abdullah Mahmoud al-Khalidi, has been assassinated by rebel forces in the capital, Damascus. The Free Syrian Army said it killed him. Meanwhile, Syrian Air Force jets and helicopter gunships have intensified their attacks on rebel positions.
Text E.
The European Court of Human Rights has ruled that a Polish teenager who was raped and became pregnant should have been given unhindered access to an abortion. Staff at three hospitals in Poland denied the 14-year-old girl a termination, even though abortion is legal in cases of rape.
This is the end of task one. Task two. You will hear a radio program. For each question, choose the best option, A, B, or C, and write the corresponding letters in the white boxes provided. Item zero is given as an example. You will hear the recording twice. Now you have 1 minute to read the questions.
The answer to our energy needs could be right under our noses, or more accurately, right under our feet. It's geothermal energy, and advocates say by mining the Earth's heat, we can release a virtually inexhaustible supply of clean power, which requires no fossil fuels, produces little in the way of greenhouse gases, and can generate electricity about as cheaply as burning coal. It's simple. Drill a hole in a hot spot and tap the heated water and steam that comes out. Geothermal is a proven technology. There are geopower plants around the world. One in Italy has been producing energy for over 100 years. But the United States is by far the world geothermal leader. We get as much electricity from geothermal energy as solar and wind combined. And the Department of Interior has big plans for geothermal. It just announced it's opening up 190 million acres of federal land in 12 western states to geothermal development. That's an area twice the size of California. Ray Brady is the energy team leader for the Interior Department's Bureau of Land Management.
Right now, we have just over 1,200 megawatts of geothermal capacity. That's enough electricity to power approximately 1.2 million homes. We could potentially increase that production by fivefold by the year 2015. By 2025, that capacity could potentially power 12 million homes.
The plan permits private energy companies to bid on public land. Half the revenue from the leases would go to the state, a quarter to the federal government, and a quarter to local counties. We're talking big bucks. Just three geothermal leases recently went for $52 million. Of course, being public land, the 190 million acres includes some of the most environmentally sensitive open spaces in the country. Ray Brady says the Department of the Interior has come up with a programmatic environmental impact statement that puts many of the areas off limits to geothermal exploitation. Mining all that heat energy in the earth is one thing. Turning it into electricity is another. Ray Brady acknowledges geothermal plants will have environmental impacts. And there will need to be new transmission lines to get the electricity to market. Thousands of miles of overhead lines are already being built in western states. But there are concerns about the environment under the ground as well. There are fears geothermal plants could trigger earthquakes. Recirculating the water back into the ground also solves two other problems. Geothermal hot water can be highly acidic and slightly radioactive. But as ambitious as the federal government's new 190 million acre geothermal plan is, it pales in comparison to the potential promise of a new technology called enhanced geothermal energy. Michael Fahler is a senior research scientist at MIT and a corporate geothermal consultant.
The idea is to drill holes and make a man-made geothermal system. And so what we do is we drill a hole and we use something called hydraulic fracturing to create a fracture system that water can flow through. And then we drill another well into that fracture system. So now we have two wells that are drilled into a fracture system. We inject water into one of them, and it flows through the fractures, absorbs heat from the earth, and it comes up hot. And then we can take the heat from that water and convert it into energy.
Potentially, enhanced geothermal opens up the entire planet for energy production. MIT researchers estimate that the Earth's usable geothermal energy could supply the world's needs for a quarter of a million years.
Listen again.
The answer to our energy needs could be right under our noses, or more accurately, right under our feet. It's geothermal energy, and advocates say by mining the Earth's heat, we can release a virtually inexhaustible supply of clean power, which requires no fossil fuels, produces little in the way of greenhouse gases, and can generate electricity about as cheaply as burning coal. It's simple. Drill a hole in a hot spot and tap the heated water and steam that comes out. Geothermal is a proven technology. There are geopower plants around the world. One in Italy has been producing energy for over 100 years. But the United States is by far the world geothermal leader. We get as much electricity from geothermal energy as solar and wind combined. And the Department of Interior has big plans for geothermal. It just announced it's opening up 190 million acres of federal land in 12 western states to geothermal development. That's an area twice the size of California. Ray Brady is the energy team leader for the Interior Department's Bureau of Land Management.
Right now, we have just over 1,200 megawatts of geothermal capacity. That's enough electricity to power approximately 1.2 million homes. We could potentially increase that production by fivefold by the year 2015. By 2025, that capacity could potentially power 12 million homes.
The plan permits private energy companies to bid on public land. Half the revenue from the leases would go to the state, a quarter to the federal government, and a quarter to local counties. We're talking big bucks. Just three geothermal leases recently went for $52 million. Of course, being public land, the 190 million acres includes some of the most environmentally sensitive open spaces in the country. Ray Brady says the Department of the Interior has come up with a programmatic environmental impact statement that puts many of the areas off limits to geothermal exploitation. Mining all that heat energy in the earth is one thing. Turning it into electricity is another. Ray Brady acknowledges geothermal plants will have environmental impacts. And there will need to be new transmission lines to get the electricity to market. Thousands of miles of overhead lines are already being built in western states. But there are concerns about the environment under the ground as well. There are fears geothermal plants could trigger earthquakes. Recirculating the water back into the ground also solves two other problems. Geothermal hot water can be highly acidic and slightly radioactive. But as ambitious as the federal government's new 190 million acre geothermal plan is, it pales in comparison to the potential promise of a new technology called enhanced geothermal energy. Michael Fahler is a senior research scientist at MIT and a corporate geothermal consultant.
The idea is to drill holes and make a man-made geothermal system. And so what we do is we drill a hole and we use something called hydraulic fracturing to create a fracture system that water can flow through. And then we drill another well into that fracture system. So now we have two wells that are drilled into a fracture system. We inject water into one of them, and it flows through the fractures, absorbs heat from the earth, and it comes up hot. And then we can take the heat from that water and convert it into energy.
Potentially, enhanced geothermal opens up the entire planet for energy production. MIT researchers estimate that the Earth's usable geothermal energy could supply the world's needs for a quarter of a million years.
This is the end of task two. Task three. Listen to the recording. For sentences 1 to 8, complete the gaps with 1 to 3 suitable words according to what you hear. Item 0 is given as an example. You will hear the recording twice. Now you have 1 minute to read the sentences.
Hello and welcome to More or Less on the BBC World Service. I'm Ruth Alexander. There's been sad news from Ethiopia.
State television in Ethiopia has announced the death of the country's Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi.
Earlier in the year, there was sad news from Ghana. Before that, Malawi. And before that, more sad news, this time from Guinea-Bissau. That's four African leaders who have died in office this year alone. Disruptive for the countries concerned, tragic for the leaders' families, and though this might not be the main concern, a lot of work for reporters. Simon Allison, a correspondent for the Daily Maverick news website in South Africa, has been trying to answer what to him seems to be the obvious question here.
Why do African presidents keep dying?
So Simon's been doing some investigating, and the resulting article has attracted a lot of attention online.
I found that 2012 has been a particularly bad year for presidential mortality, but the trend goes back a bit further. Going back to 2008, I found that there were nine African presidents that had died in office. In the space of 4 years, to have nine leaders die seems quite excessive. And looking further afield at the rest of the world as a sort of comparison, and I only found three other countries whose president had died in office in the last 4 years. That was North Korea, Poland, and Barbados in the Caribbean. And that was it.
Our own statistics correspondent, Charlotte MacDonald, has been having a look to see if there's more to it. Charlotte?
It's certainly true that leaders are dying in office in Africa in higher numbers than on any other continent.
In fact, Simon's underestimated the problem. Not nine, but 10 have passed away since 2008.
Yes, you might think the obvious explanation is that African leaders are older than those of other continents, but that's not really the case. The average age of an African leader is 61, but that's the same as Asia. South American leaders are younger, they're 59 on average, while Europeans are 55.
But were the leaders who have died older than average?
Yes, their average was 67. But another thing to consider is life expectancy, which among the general population is lower in Africa than in places like Europe, Latin America and Asia. Dr. George Leeson, a gerontologist from Oxford University in the UK, says a poor childhood can have a lasting impact.
For African presidents, they will, before they become elected as a president, have lived a relatively disadvantaged life. So once they get into the presidential office, even though they will be living a lifestyle far, far, far removed from that of their fellow citizens, which would increase their life expectancy in relation to those fellow citizens even more, but they do have an accumulated disadvantageous lifestyle, which they have to pay back on at some time.
Although not all African leaders will have had poor childhoods, of course. But is there another factor in all of this? Politics. The stereotypical African leader clings on to power until he drops.
Well, Simon Allison isn't sure the facts fit that explanation.
This is true of some of the leaders who died in office, particularly we're talking about Omar Bongo, Conte and Gaddafi, all of whom were old-school dictators who were never going to leave power voluntarily. But the others are different. So Meles Zenawi, who just died recently, he has clung on to power for a long time, but also he's only 57, so he doesn't really fall into the dying in old age in office category. And all the others were within their constitutional term limits and hadn't even fiddled with them yet.
Of course, all this might be statistically meaningless, a blip if you like, but Simon says that whatever's really going on, it creates uncertainty.
Obviously, a death in office leads to a power vacuum, and power vacuums can be dangerous and destabilizing. Look at what happened in Guinea-Bissau. When Sanha died, a coup followed very shortly afterwards. This is a difficult situation for Africa to find itself in because it historically has not dealt very well with power vacuums. However, there is some cause for optimism on this front. In Zambia, in Malawi, in Ghana, and in Nigeria, the death of the president was followed by the constitutional succession with a minimum of violence and dispute around the issue. And I think this is a very encouraging sign for Africa's development.
Listen again.
Hello and welcome to More or Less on the BBC World Service. I'm Ruth Alexander. there's been sad news from Ethiopia.
State television in Ethiopia has announced the death of the country's Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi.
Earlier in the year, there was sad news from Ghana. Before that, Malawi. And before that, more sad news, this time from Guinea-Bissau. That's four African leaders who have died in office this year alone. Disruptive for the countries concerned, tragic for the leaders' families, and though this might not be the main concern, a lot of work for reporters. Simon Allison, a correspondent for the Daily Maverick news website in South Africa, has been trying to answer what to him seems to be the obvious question here.
Why do African presidents keep dying?
So Simon's been doing some investigating, and the resulting article has attracted a lot of attention online.
I found that 2012 has been a particularly bad year for presidential mortality, but the trend goes back a bit further. Going back to 2008, I found that there were nine African presidents that had died in office. In the space of 4 years, to have nine leaders die seems quite excessive. And looking further afield at the rest of the world as a sort of comparison, and I only found three other countries whose president had died in office in the last 4 years. That was North Korea, Poland, and Barbados in the Caribbean. And that was it.
Our own statistics correspondent, Charlotte MacDonald, has been having a look to see if there's more to it. Charlotte?
It's certainly true that leaders are dying in office in Africa in higher numbers than on any other continent.
In fact, Simon's underestimated the problem. Not nine, but 10 have passed away since 2008.
Yes, you might think the obvious explanation is that African leaders are older than those of other continents, but that's not really the case. The average age of an African leader is 61, but that's the same as Asia. South American leaders are younger, they're 59 on average, while Europeans are 55.
But were the leaders who have died older than average?
Yes, their average was 67. But another thing to consider is life expectancy, which among the general population is lower in Africa than in places like Europe, Latin America and Asia. Dr. George Leeson, a gerontologist from Oxford University in the UK, says a poor childhood can have a lasting impact.
For African presidents, they will, before they become elected as a president, have lived a relatively disadvantaged life. So once they get into the presidential office, even though they will be living a lifestyle far, far, far removed from that of their fellow citizens, which would increase their life expectancy in relation to those fellow citizens even more, but they do have an accumulated disadvantageous lifestyle, which they have to pay back on at some time.
Although not all African leaders will have had poor childhoods, of course. But is there another factor in all of this? Politics. The stereotypical African leader clings on to power until he drops.
Well, Simon Allison isn't sure the facts fit that explanation.
This is true of some of the leaders who died in office, particularly we're talking about Omar Bongo, Conte and Gaddafi, all of whom were old-school dictators who were never going to leave power voluntarily. But the others are different. So Meles Zenawi, who just died recently, he has clung on to power for a long time, but also he's only 57, so he doesn't really fall into the dying in old age in office category. And all the others were within their constitutional term limits and hadn't even fiddled with them yet.
Of course, all this might be statistically meaningless, a blip if you like, but Simon says that whatever's really going on, it creates uncertainty.
Obviously, a death in office leads to a power vacuum, and power vacuums can be dangerous and destabilizing. Look at what happened in Guinea-Bissau. When Sanha died, a coup followed very shortly afterwards. This is a difficult situation for Africa to find itself in because it historically has not dealt very well with power vacuums. However, there is some cause for optimism on this front. In Zambia, in Malawi, in Ghana, and in Nigeria, the death of the president was followed by the constitutional succession with a minimum of violence and dispute around the issue. And I think this is a very encouraging sign for Africa's development.
This is the end of Task 3 and the end of the listening comprehension test.